Welcome to the Technoid Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Catoon. In the show today, good friend Stuart Frankel of Narrative Science. I'm a big fan of Narrative Science, and Stu, I think it's one of Chicago's gems. I love this is a 9-year overnight success story, which is what I think is going to end up happening here. Before we hit up Stuart and talk to him, I want to first check our startup inbox. It is brought to you by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with Truly Automation by signing up at activecampaign.com/technori. Get your first 2 months for free. June Zimmer, established new lines of business. A recent tweak to our software my team developed for our core product of performing so well, I'm considering launching this software as a separate service. Okay, so like this is actually fairly common. We've got like here locally, Sean Rigsacker from Centro. Might as well call the business Basis. Centro is the company's name, but its Basis is like their primary product. And then the other example of this, also speaking of Narrative Science, Stuart was a part of Relativity, well, K-Cura at one point too. K-Cura, their number one product was called Relativity, and now they just changed the name of the company to Relativity. So it's a kind of the similar thing here. The question is, how much do you want to manage? How much do you want to try to be two things at one time or three things at one time? If you have a product or service that like served as a core and this new service line can be even bigger, maybe you want to spin it off as two. If it's bigger, big enough that you're considering moving off of your core product, maybe you should just focus all of your attention on this product and keep everything going and support the other one. I think too often entrepreneurs like, they're like ADDDDDD. They chase anything that comes in front of them. Try one thing, be successful at it before you move on to the next thing. And if you find something that's as successful or more successful than what you're currently doing, just switch. Just switch. Move on to the next thing. That's the best I can give you on that. So with that said, I'm going to switch over to a conversation with Stuart Frankel, the CEO and founder of Narrative Science, which I think you will find incredibly helpful. So I figured there's no better way to start this than before here. I came here straight from Howard Tolman's new office at IIT, at the Kaplan Institute, which is, I think I saw a picture. You've taken the tour there, I assume?
You know, I've taken a lot of tours with Howard. I can't
remember which one.
Yeah.
So I will leave it at this, and Howard, I'm sure we'll catch this part of the show. I guaranteed that he'll listen long enough to catch this. Let's put it that way. The conversation we had, which I think is very pertinent to you and the growth that you guys are coming into, is talent. Where and how is Chicago going to continue to find and source and develop the talent in the tech space? And we've got, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and these companies that are coming here, and that's all great for everybody. It's great for everybody. The mayor changes, we'll see how that shakes out, but from a tech standpoint, we've got the universities, everything looks perfect, and yet Howard and I were sitting there in the chair going, how are we going to make sure that Chicago still has a competitive advantage and that we can develop talent here? You are a person who's going to be hiring a lot of this talent, hypothetically.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? What are you looking at as a Chicago CEO right now?
Well, this is the topic, right? So right? If you sit around and you talk to a bunch of CEOs, everybody is really talking about the same thing. It does not help that it is a white hot economy and that, you know, technology workers, let alone technology workers, but really everybody else, they've got kind of any opportunity that they want. They don't like doing something, they can pick up and go do something else. So mobility, I think, is very much a function of sort of where we are as a society, but also where our economy is, you know, where our economy is today. In a interesting way, I think the fact that the Facebooks and Amazons and larger companies are coming here, I think it actually creates more stickiness for prospective employees and for people who are Midwesterners. They went to school around here, or they came from outside of the Midwest and went to school around here. And the reason that they haven't stayed in the past is because there weren't enough opportunities, or they didn't think, frankly, there would be enough opportunities to fill up a career, right? So when we try to recruit people from outside of Chicago, for example, it's never about the job at Narrative Science.
Yeah.
It's about,
what happens after
what
that?
Do I do next, yeah. right? And they look around and, you know, the fields have been relatively empty. So I think that those, I think that the presence of those companies, while on the one hand create competition for companies like Narrative Science, it also creates this this network effect, if you will, or this sort of regional effect that winds up actually working in the long run in our favor. And when the economy in particular slows down, I think you'll wind up looking around and have a lot of really talented prospective employees, and it'll be a bit easier to hire.
I tend to totally agree with you on this. I think, as I said actually this morning with Howard, we both sort of jostled back and forth on this, is that like there's kind of two pieces to this. The first one is a lot of people who graduated from universities in Chicago or not in Chicago, but maybe they were from here and they came home for the summer and was like, there's a startup tech scene here enough now. And it's been growing obviously, but like for the last couple of years, 3 years, it's been sufficient enough that I think it's an attraction. The question has been, do I want to plant my roots here? Because will there be something if this startup, which most likely will fail, doesn't work out? And I don't want to be known among the scene here that like, this is what I was able to do. And I don't create any sort of network for myself in the career path. And now I think it's starting to change. And so like the thought of worrying about the Facebooks of the world from that perspective, I actually think it's easier for you to recruit, which is kind of your point. The other part of this, and you know, obviously from conversations we've had, that we're fairly heavily invested in the offshore resources. And Howard and I talked about the fact that if you want to look at it this way, the universities, those that choose to play around and actually want to advance their curriculum beyond what they're currently doing, can be looked at as an outsource or offshore in a way resource for a lot of the companies here as well. They just don't know it yet. That if they had kids who were undergrad and graduate students at IIT, could they be trained on certain things as a part of their degree and start working for companies like Narrative Science before they graduate, to handle things that maybe aren't so forward and front facing? And I think that's a brilliant play on Howard's part.
Yeah, I agree. Look, I think that we've got the opportunity, and we actually do this in Narrative Science. We actually have a pretty robust internship program. Yeah. You know, we've got about 100 employees and we've got 12 interns this year, right? So it's a pretty high percentage. And there are other industries that have cracked this code. You look at engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, co-ops, and other programs like that, where you spend, 4 years in school, but in the middle somewhere you spend a year working at a company. That's really already been perfected. And I think clearly we could borrow some things from other industries and apply that and give people that real world opportunity, within the confines of their education.
It's interesting to me, like, maybe I'm slightly obtuse in this manner because like I didn't grow up, I'm obviously non-technical, so I didn't grow up paying attention to it. I have friends who were deeply into computer science early on throughout their college career, and some of them dropped out to pursue things, and that like makes sense. It's like that Mark Zuckerberg dropped out of college and started a thing. A bunch of them pursued, I think, their engineering chops and like different languages and things to make themselves useful, semi to like solve their own problems, like gamers and things like that. And those are the ones that I have found, if I had to make a bet, those are the ones I'm going to bet on from a technical founder kind of standpoint. But what I have noticed is that a lot of, and this is for like those that are age 26 to like 30 right now, that went to college, graduated with a degree that has no bearing on anything currently and in the future going on, and they're technical now via General Assembly and, different types of coding academies that are teaching them, which those are definitely necessary and good. But I wonder if that's also part of the problem with like the current landscape. There's only so much high talent people to go around right now because we've got this sort of dearth of like what I would call native technologists.
I think there's some merit to that, but I also think that there's always a quality range, right?
Yeah.
And I think you, depending on externalities, again, the economy being one of those, that range might be pretty significant because it lets people in to programs and industries that they might otherwise not be able to get into if the economy wasn't as hot, right? And you know, the easiest way to tell whether the economy is hot or cold is what kind of service are you getting in quick service restaurants, right? Sure. If you're getting killer service in a quick serve restaurant, you know the economy is not doing so well.
Yeah.
If it's really poor service, right?
You're this like is such okay. a good point.
You're like, okay, I know what's going on here. So as things cool off, and certainly they eventually will, and I don't want to sound like a doom and gloom person. I'm not predicting that, but all of this is of course cyclical. I do think that that the opportunities to just hire high quality employees will be there. We've lived through this through, you know, the dot-com bust. We've lived through this in 08, 09, and 2010, and you know that will certainly repeat itself.
I was just going to say, to make sure that we don't feel like there's a doom and gloom here, I actually feel like, and maybe this is just the psycho entrepreneur in me, when things are chaotic, I tend to actually feel like more comfortable. Because like all the time that I'm sitting here when things are going well, I'm just like, when is it going to fall? Like I'm just waiting for whether it's the economy or my personal life, whatever. When is too many things are going good? When is it going to tumble to the bottom? And so like to me, I kind of like the disarray of a chaotic environment.
Yeah. Well, look, it's certainly much more fun to operate. And I think the thing with, you know, prospective employees, and if you zoom out at a macro level, I agree, there's, you know, a shortage of talent. If you zoom back in and you go company by company, if you've got a company, and I certainly believe that we have one at Narrative Science that is really trying to solve a really difficult, important problem, and you've got a good culture, and you treat people right, it doesn't matter what's going on in the economy. It doesn't matter, you know, what the shortage of prospective employees is like. You're going to be able to build a team, because every company isn't the same, right? And everybody does not have the same thing to offer every prospective employee. And also people change jobs, right? They do, particularly engineers. You know, they're spending a lot less time, unfortunately, at every company. But I guess the positive piece of that is that there is always talent rolling off somewhere, whether it's new graduates or whether it's people who've been in a company for a while.
I think it's actually a huge advantage, to be totally honest. I think the turnover among engineers is, there's going to be consistency and culture things that make it maybe a little harder for you as a CEO to keep things rolling right. But I think the idea of new ideas, new innovation, new thought, new traction, new energy, for if a company is good, the founders and the leadership is good and the culture is strong, new ideas is like, it's better than money.
Yeah, look, every open headcount is an opportunity, right? When you hire somebody 2 years ago, it doesn't mean that they're not still great, but your company has changed over the course of 2 years. And if somebody winds up leaving, then it just gives you an opportunity to say, okay, what do I need now for the next 2 years or the next 5 years without being burdened by some of the assumptions that you made previously.
Yeah, I totally agree. So let's move on a little bit more to you. I mean, we've had you on the show several times, and I've never actually like asked you questions about your own personal life. Like, it's interesting to me, like the common thread of a lot of the successful founders we've had on this show and otherwise has been their upbringing. There are certain things that just make them unique. Goddard is one who stands out. Tim is also, his co-founder is also another person who has like a incredibly unique story that you're like, wow, after I hear this, everything I see at G2 makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you? What did your parents do? Where did you grow up? What was life for the little Stuart?
By the way, that's a lot of pressure. I'm thinking back.
You have no pressure.
My Midwestern.
We have editing skills. It's a podcast. There's no pressure.
You know, two parents, two sisters. I grew up in Cincinnati, actually. And my mom was a teacher. My dad was an accountant. He worked in an accounting firm. There's no question that the one common thing that I take from both of them is that they worked incredibly, incredibly hard. My dad's pretty old school in the feeling of you get up and you go to work.
Yep.
And that's certainly something that, you know, that I learned. But, you know, I had a great childhood. I went to public schools. I worked all through high school and even before high school. That was an expectation.
What was your first job?
In my house.
What was the first
job? My first job was actually working at what essentially was a giant flea market. And I worked for a guy who had a clothing stand in the flea market. And my job was to was to organize all the ties. He had boxes of ties. People would walk in. They'd mess up all the ties. They'd pick one, and they'd leave, and he would point to me, and I would be off to the side, and I would move in, and I would straighten the ties. That was the entire job.
So that's like we – that's not where I was thinking that was going to go. I'm like taking – so like we recently had Victor, the founder of Guaranteed Rate on about a week ago. And I have this little thing in my head. Sometimes I say it to people, and sometimes I don't say it. Of like, I'm trying to predict, like, what was your first job? But when I first, what I knew of him made me believe that it was cutlery. I was positive that he sold knives.
Yeah.
He just
that's
looks
a good
like he
it's a good guess.
Right?
Too,
he just looks like someone who would just love to cut a penny in front of a grandma.
Yeah.
Like, that's just his
Were
thing.
You right?
I was wrong. His first job, this is even more Victor than what I thought. He would go and spray paint addresses on the curbs and then ask you for money.
Yeah.
So he didn't ask first.
That's from my era. That's classic. That was a classic gig.
Right?
Yeah.
And it was like, man, I'm like, this is one of the themes. I'll just touch on them as we go through this. But like, they're like strange first job. They're not what you think. They're not like I was a caddy at my dad's country club. They're not the really successful founders. And I don't mean this for everybody, but the vast majority of founders that I've met who are not just money successful, but like successful builders of companies and builders of people and teams. Their first jobs are bizarre.
Yeah.
They're reorganizing ties.
I think the closest thing I had to a traditional kid job was I had a lawn mowing business.
Of course.
Right? Which almost every kid, you know, had at some point in their life. And, you know, frankly, that's a good business when you're 12 or 13 years old and you hustle. You can make some dough, but I wound up actually getting a job in the 10th grade when I got my driver's license. I delivered orders for a local pharmacy, and I wound up staying there for 3 years. And I was there long enough that I was able to sort of work myself up, you know, through the organization. Yeah. So I became a supervisor of some other people who delivered, and then I wound up going into the back office for a while and. It was a great job. I actually loved working in high school, and you know, I had a little money to spend, and it was a great lesson.
I want to go back to the lessons on that in a second. I want to give a quick shout out speaking to the lawn mowing job. There's a kid in our neighborhood, and this will be a short little interrupted story between the two of us. This kid, I don't know who the hell he is, and I've never seen him before. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting out at my parents' house, and I'm like, who is this kid running through the backyards? Like, reminds me of me. He's like, this is like everywhere. I don't know. He doesn't belong here. Like, I don't know what's going on. And I see him all out the neighborhood. He lives, I guess, down the street, and he started a lawn care for himself business and a snow plow. And he's got them all. He's seasonal. And he just like signed up every single neighbor. And it struck me. I literally turned on my mom and I was like, that's a kid I would bet on. I would put money in a fund for that kid right now.
Yeah.
Like all day long, which goes to the question on, and this is, like I said, a brief sidebar. You starting to see people betting on college kids to pay for their education.
Yeah.
And at first when I saw it, I was like, this is insane. Like, this feels wrong. But now after having the experience, this is like 2 weeks ago with this kid, I kind of think I'm in. Like, I kind of like the idea of like, I know people who are successful. I see it coming.
Well, you're betting on hustle, right, as the thing that is the early indicator, and I would agree with that.
And he
that.
Doesn't look like he's tiring. He looks like if he wasn't doing this, he'd be bored out of his mind.
Yeah. The other thing that's really interesting about that type of business is it's not a new industry. It's not high tech. It's one of those things where you feel like there can't be any opportunity. Everybody must have a person
yep.
who mows their lawn. Clearly, in this case, they either didn't or they had somebody that they didn't think was doing a good job. So even when you're in a super competitive industry, for example, if you hustle and you're resilient, you work hard enough, you're going to be able to carve something out.
I'll tell you what, I will take on leverage to bet on this kid if I see him start buying salt in bulk and like figuring out a way to have an electric lawnmower plugged into their house instead of gas. If I see him start penny pinching like that, this kid's got my money.
Well, wait until he buys the kid's business in the neighborhood next door too.
Boom. Yeah. That's he's leveraging economies of scale at 12. Okay. So I want to go back to your first job, not first job, but the first kind of where you had to button up a shirt job and the lessons that you kind of learned in that, because I think that those years of formative years, usually, and this is speaking for myself a little bit, but also listening to the conversations with a lot of founders like yourself, it's less about unless you're fortunate. It's less about somebody putting their hand on my shoulder and saying, like, listen, this is kind of what it's like to be a boss and a manager, treat people right, that sort of thing. It's usually getting treated like shit and then having to, like, see bad things and be like, I'm not going to be that person. What were the lessons and what did you see and experience then as a young kind of first real employee that you now covet when you hire people?
Yeah. Well, I had a few other jobs during this time period, and what I noticed among all, I always worked for, you know, essentially smaller companies, right, local companies, and the principal, the person who owned it, right, whether it was the drugstore, I also worked at a restaurant, they were there all the time, and they were super hands-on, and they were hands-on with their employees, they were hands-on with their customers. Now, that doesn't scale if you're trying to build a giant company, or certainly a chain of 1,000 drugstores. But I think the message in there is that you got to be pretty close to the details, no matter how high you are up in an organization. And it's pretty important that you keep your finger on the pulse of what's going on. Now, the downside that I learned from that was it's really annoying.
Yeah.
When somebody doesn't trust you, or they're constantly asking you questions about why you didn't do this, or when are you going to get to this? And so I think I learned pretty early that you've got to find that right balance between being extremely involved, but also, hiring people and enabling people. And I certainly didn't call it that then.
Yeah.
And didn't think about it that way. But when I reflect back, that's exactly what it was.
Oh,
I also worked for, you know, assholes.
That's
part of, I think, growing up. And if you can work for the assholes early, I think it gives you a competitive advantage.
I was just going to say, I totally agree. I think, listen, there are some people, it's like anything in life. You know, bad husbands, bad spouses, bad partners, bad whatever. You know, they some people replicate bad behavior and other people recognize bad behavior. And they know to be a different or a better person. And I think ultimately when I look at my first employer was not the best. And it was sort of like so smart and so much potential. Oh my God.
What was your job?
So I was in commercial real estate. I'm not going to say the name because he's probably listening somewhere. Brilliant. And he's made off very well. I was managing commercial properties. This is why I said you all like chaos. So I would look for, this is right before the recession and then through the recession. I looked for chaos and distressed properties to the point of ridiculous, like people living on the roof of commercial strip mall properties, and ultimately recognized that I would need to figure out how to bring value to them. And this guy was sort of a person who I think believed you could squeeze blood out of a turnip, and that too bad you're the turnip,
right?
Kind of thing. And it is like, and that was one of those things, like sometimes he would have made way more money if he was nice about it. And that was sort of the only lesson that needed to be made on that. And I think I look at this and I look at guys like yourself and I think if you could build a company and it be known for, it was a successful company, but be known for, and Chris Gladwin talks a lot about this, like be known for the people who exited my company, whether it was earlier at the end, and what they built, that would be, it's kind of like a coaching tree, that would be a very proud thing.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good way to measure, or certainly one way to measure the kind of impact that you can have on employees and their life and their career trajectory, for sure. And that actually starts with the kind of people that you hire, right? So I think you have to obviously hire the right people for your organization at the right time. Chris, I'm sure, hired people similar to the people that we hired at Narrative Science very early, lots of utility players, just hustlers, and you know, people who just wanted to be part of something new and frankly didn't need a lot of details on what that was going to look, what that was going to look like. And those are the kinds of people who eventually go on to start their own things because they're really comfortable.
And they learned a ton because they had to do a ton.
And they got their MBA, right?
Yeah.
Working in one of those.
That was the one thing I would say, thankfully, for my experience. I do give, and I said to him last time I saw him, I give you almost all of the credit of the success that I've had to this point because I was thrown into a fire. I didn't know I just finished college. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And then the recession hit. So I literally don't know what I'm doing. He was basically like, follow the path to revenue. Like, you learn good whatever advice. You got to learn to get right. there, figure it out. And it was like, well, you didn't have to say it like such a prick, but thank you. I will do this. So I want to hone in on one of the things you just kind of said a second ago and then got us back on track with the hiring comment, which is to say, I had a conversation recently with one of the kin of the Malnati family and the Lou Malnati of Chicago Pizza. And it reminded me of a conversation I had with Dick Portillo. And this may not make any sense to those listening at this current juncture, but it will in a minute. The question that they had to figure out was, do I want to, and you mentioned this before, do I want to franchise 1,000 ways? And you said, you know, I can't really scale unless I do that, until they figured out a way that they could scale and still keep it from being that like hands off franchise model. The question that they had to solve for, and this is the question I'm posing to you, is both interesting for the audience and for myself. As a CEO or the founder, and sometimes it's not necessarily the same thing, obviously, you have a certain skill set that makes this idea work. There's something that you can do that very few people can do the way you do it. Your unfair advantage that is the easiest thing for you to do is this one thing or several things. When you start to scale a company, the problem is you have to start taking on the role of whatever professional. It's a CEO, you have responsibilities, which cut into you doing things that are maybe your most natural skill set. How do you figure out, when should I hire people to either take on some of the quote unquote CEO roles so that I can never take my finger off the pulse of my unfair advantage, versus I think I can teach this and I should hire people who are going to have to do some of the things that I do best? Because what they both said to me was, they learned the hard way. They took their finger off what they did the best and they lost very, very quickly and came back to it, obviously, successfully.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different ways to look at that. I'm of the view that you can't really hire people to do CEO things.
Yeah.
Unless you're...
Well, it depends on what you look at. You know,
exactly.
What you call CEO
right.
things.
Yeah. And so I do think that a lot of people have to learn how to be a CEO when they're a founder, right?
I would agree.
That's pretty
that.
Important. And so I think it's pretty important that you recognize that. I have said this before when I give talks on other podcasts. You know, I'm 53 years old, and I don't think I've ever felt like I knew less,
yeah.
right? And so as you grow and as you mature, both physically but in your organization, you have to start realizing how very little you ultimately know. And that's where you then have to kind of fill it in with other people.
Yeah.
I am a big believer in, you know, hiring obviously the best people that you can, people who have hopefully done it before. You'd mentioned teaching people. I think you can teach people in industry. You can certainly teach them culture. But as you get to a certain size and a certain scale, it's pretty important to bring people in who have actually done that before and have a playbook and can apply that to your business.
I think, yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think the part that has always been difficult for myself and for other founders and for people who are, I mean, honestly, it's not even first-time founders, repeat founders, people who, by all accounts, people would say have been successful. They're only successful up to a certain point, and that's when they hit this threshold where they have to recognize that my particular skill set is limited to this. And maybe that's, maybe it's them not understanding what the role of a CEO is. Maybe the role of a CEO at 10 to 25 people Series A is to convince investors that there's something here and to get people to be crazy enough to jump off the cliff with you. But that doesn't mean that you know how to build a team and chart, you know, org chart and to keep the capital running and manage budgets and in that.
So look, hopefully you're self-aware enough that you realize you don't know that stuff and you get some help, whether that's through hiring other people or, you know, some type of coaching or just, you know, a friend or an advisor or a mentor. But certainly if you take outside money, that is the job of the board and the investors.
Yeah.
And it's not to just obviously give you the money and hope for the best. And, you know, I think most investors, certainly in early stage companies, are more involved in that. But they have to take a very conscious approach and a very methodical approach to developing, particularly a young founder who has not, you know, been in a company that's been successful before, that doesn't necessarily have general management skills, that can't read a balance sheet, can't read a P&L. They have to just acknowledge that and say, we're going to teach you how to do this. Yep. And they either do that themselves or, again, they find a coach or they find a mentor. And I think that's one of the most important things that a board member can do. If he or she can't do that themselves, they need to then help that CEO go find that right person. And I think often the case, it is somebody not on the board. Yeah. You want to be really truthful and transparent with your board, but you also want to talk to somebody.
You need a confidant
where you can, you know, you can tell them, hey, I'm not feeling great right now.
Yeah.
About this. Can you help me walk through it without judgment, right?
Yep.
And without somebody kind of taking that and spinning that into something that it just isn't.
So you'd mentioned kind of the CEO role. I feel like it differs for a lot of different companies. It's the CEO role, I think, is kind of what you make it in some, you know, depending on who you are. Like taking over for Uber's Travis Kalanick, that's a different job than taking over for Microsoft, and also a different job from starting a brand new company. I feel like in a lot of cases, some of the founders and CEOs, and this is going to pivot into the kind of narrative science piece of this, and also come full circle with the conversation with Howard this morning, which was that a lot of CEOs maybe and founders, because of the bravado that they have to create in order to sell the team to jump into this and to raise capital from people, are either ignorant of the fact or they've suppressed it to where they don't ask for help to like learn how to read. Like it seems like so obvious. I'm the CEO and the founder of this company. It's already raised $10 million. Naturally, I know, you know, how to follow cash flow, right?
Yeah.
But I don't. And I'm too proud or too scared or whatever, to your point of the conciliary that they don't have, to admit it and to learn how to read, essentially, from a business standpoint. And I think that's one thing that should be done no matter what, is like without judgment. Like, I don't expect that you ever been a CEO before? No, or yes, but not in this level. Like, I don't expect you to know this.
Part of that comes from the way that we treat fundraises, which is that we celebrate them, and you certainly should. But I think that we celebrate them to the point where we think that equals success.
Yeah.
And you realize pretty quickly that's just the beginning, right?
Yeah.
That is nowhere near.
Isn't that the truth?
Near an end. And so, listen, I think that you can feel that way. You can feel very successful. You know, everybody's congratulating you. You're the toast of the town. You know, every vendor selling something is calling you, of course. But I think you can feel successful because there has been.
It feels like validation.
That's exactly right. There's an endorsement that has been made. But again, it's the beginning of the process. It's not near the end. And that is the time, obviously, to be the most paranoid. And there have been people who have written about this, that it's one of their scariest moments when they realize that they've raised a lot of money. And you know, we've raised $40 million, and that is not insignificant. It's not giant as it used to be, but it's certainly not insignificant. And there's a lot of pressure that comes with that in terms of delivering to everybody, to your employees and to your investors. And if you don't feel that, I think that eventually then you may run into some issues, because everything doesn't always go, you know, the way that you want it to.
Well, I think they don't quite get that if I raised X dollars for my Series A, that like everyone preceding that was expecting a 10X, and now everyone after that is expecting at least a 3 or 4X, and it's probably more than that.
You're always disappointing somebody.
Correct, yeah. Right. No matter what's going to happen, like you've set yourself up to where, like, and we were talking about this in the conversation this morning, like there's a few companies we will not name because they come on the show a lot, who've raised a ton of money, and they have only but one way to be judged as successful from here on out. So I hope they got their clapping out of the way, because it's going to be push hard for the rest of the route to see what, if it really is successful. And again, success we're measuring in cash, and it shouldn't be. There's plenty of pride to be had of building even what they've built now.
For sure.
What about narrative science? So obviously you mentioned you've raised $40 million, not an insignificant amount of money. What that responsibility means that you've got to build a company that does X and Y. What does that look like for you? What is narrative science's mission continuing to be, and how does this capital put you in a better position to be there?
Yeah, so you know, we've been at this for about 9 years or so.
So overnight success.
Overnight success, exactly. And I think the good news is we're pretty much doing, and we pretty much talk about the company in a similar way to when we started the company 9 years ago. The messaging has evolved. Certainly the market has evolved quite a bit. But we do data storytelling. So we've developed a series of technologies, or a suite of technologies, that you know, all essentially do the same thing, but for in different ways and for different audiences. And they take data and they analyze that data, and then they render that output into plain English stories. And the idea is that most people in an organization don't want to, or certainly shouldn't, or don't have the skills to sift through data and look at spreadsheets and look at business intelligence tools. They just need information to make a decision and do their job better. Yep. And storytelling, data storytelling, is the way that that the way that that happens. So interestingly, even though we've been around for a while, I feel like we're just beginning in many ways. You know, when we launched the business in 2010, we were talking about things like language as the next interface, but we were talking about that before Siri was on the iPhone,
yep.
before Amazon Alexa. When I tell people what narrative science does today, I get head nods and people say, of course something like this exists.
Yeah.
In 2010, that was not the response.
I'm going to guess the 40 million was raised a little closer to today than it was in 2010.
Well, it was, you know, we were fortunate, but we certainly have raised, you know, yeah. Sort of the bulk of it in the last 5 years or so. Yeah. But, you know, I think that the really good news, though, is what's happening in the market. I think that there has been some real recognition that existing solutions out there aren't necessarily the right solutions for everybody in an organization. And when you think about business intelligence and you think about data, particularly in large enterprises in particular, it's actually amazing there hasn't been more progress on that last mile piece,
yep.
how the information actually gets to a decision maker. And, you know, the analogy that we'll often use is, you know, consumer applications, right? So you look at the way we get information today, and from consumer apps like Netflix or Amazon or Apple News, it's a really great experience. At least that's the way that I feel. The more you use these products, the better they get. And the higher your satisfaction is, and the less work you have to do.
Yeah.
In the enterprise, it's very different. Think about how if Netflix were a enterprise application, you'd get a big dump of data with every movie that was ever made. Each movie would have a whole bunch of attributes. You'd dump that into something like Tableau. You'd get some beautiful graphs and charts. You'd drill down on the comedy bar on a bar chart, and you'd keep drilling and drilling and drilling, and I guess eventually you would find a movie that you were interested in watching, but what a terrible experience.
Yeah.
And yet in the enterprise, we're okay with that experience. And it's really about rethinking, I think, how information is consumed in an enterprise and how much data people need versus the information they need. The reality is, and this is what we have believed since the beginning, people don't want the data. We've given more and more people in large organizations access to data. We've given them BI tools. We've given them analytical tools. We have tried to convince them that they like data and that they like that experience. And, you know, we seem to be okay with people spending a couple hours digging into data. But the reality is that most people don't like data. This idea that everybody loves data, and you hear this slogan all the time.
I think they have to say that.
It's complete bullshit.
Yeah, I totally agree.
It's ridiculous, actually. We don't care about the data that goes to helping our Netflix experience, right? Just give me what I want to watch. And we believe now that the way that you fix that problem is through data story problem. Just give me the story. Give me what an analyst would give me if she had 30 minutes to look at a bunch of data and give me just the information I need. And stories are a great way to do that. People ask me all the time, why stories? Aren't pictures better? You know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. We communicate by talking,
yeah.
right? We either do that like we're doing today. We do it by email. We do it by chat.
Picture's also a little too subjective.
Well, it's also lacking context,
yeah.
right? And so, you know, we're not all walking around playing a giant game of charades. You and I aren't holding pictures up right now and pointing to things and trying to figure out what each of us is trying to communicate. Stories are really they're memorable, you know, and they can often be really personal. And so they're very valuable tools for communicating information. And that's our belief. And I think we've been doing this. You know, we've got over 100 large enterprise customers today. We've got integrations with every major BI company out there. And I think there's no better endorsement than a BI company partnering with us and adding language to their visualization platforms. I think there's real recognition there that pictures aren't enough, yeah. And that, you know, some type of explanation, assisted explanation, is really important. And then, you know, we're super excited about a new product that we're actually just launching called Lexio, which really embodies a lot of the things that we've been working on for the last several years and puts it in a very consumer-like application that essentially is an analytics product for everybody in the organization who isn't a business analyst or isn't a data scientist and who just needs the information. And we just launched the product actually a few weeks ago. It's been in beta for a number of months. It is a interactive data storytelling product, ships with integrations to third-party data sources like Salesforce. And you don't have to do anything. You just log in to the product, you give us your Salesforce credentials, we suck all that data in, and we instantly then give you interactive stories that you can certainly view. You can collaborate via Google Docs-like yep. collaboration tools. You can send stuff to people. You can schedule the delivery of reports and other things like that. And we're pretty excited. We're pretty excited about it. We're really encouraged with what we've seen in our beta, and we think in many ways it represents a pretty significant piece of our future.
I don't want to make this, I don't know how to even phrase this without sounding, I don't mean this in any condescension. I mean, this is like a great story. What you just said, I think, is the story that summarizes like the tortoise and the rabbit. Like, you guys for 9 years have sort of had this premise that no matter how much money and time you run behind data and big data and all these big buzzy words that we use, the knowledge in people, the average Joe in particular, but people across, even the smartest people, don't want to look at a bunch of dots that aren't even connected. And they sure as shit don't want to connect them. And so, yes, 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 you guys race out, raise your money. Yes, go do whatever it is you think you're going to do. Everyone will say, yes, I love this in beta, because they have to. Otherwise, they're going to get fired. But when it comes time to actually sign the dotted line and use the product, or at least renew the product, because they'll all say yes the first time under pressure, right. But renew and use, they won't use it because the adoption rate will be zero.
Yeah.
And you guys just slowly kept building this product to a point mm-hmm. where it was like...
Well, I agree with you, by the way, and I'm not offended by that at all, and it didn't come across as condescending. You know, I think if you want to do something new, you want to do something different where a market does not exist, you have to be pretty convicted, and you have yeah. to be willing to put the time in. And I have told our team repeatedly that our number one strategic imperative is just to be around when the market actually opens up and starts to explode for what we do. And we're really starting to feel that. You know, we're not out painting a vision of the future anymore. We're actually out painting a view of the present, and the problems that we're solving are real, easily acknowledged, particularly by senior people in an organization. And you know, I'm pretty bullish on what the next few years looks like for us.
I would tend to be on your side with this. I don't know how long we've been trying to talk to companies about, you know, the use of our marketing ability and what we know about talking to people like you, like what I could tell you about what your, whether it's content or it's product market fit, what I can tell you about the audience that's your audience, because I know them because they're my audience. If I sell you on the idea of the data source, like I'll give you all this information. They go, yeah, third meeting and it's out. If I just said, here's what you need to do, they'll pay you whatever you ask them for, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly the thought, and that's what we're seeing.
Folks, we're in the wrong business. We gotta jump over to narrative sciences business. Stuart, this has been really insightful and fun. It's nice to like get to actually learn more about you and sort of the development that it took to get to this point. Where do people go to learn more about narrative science or to apply to work for you?
Go to narrativescience.com. Lots of information there, and Twitter @narrativesci.
Yep.
SCI. And then find us on LinkedIn.
Very cool. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Of course. You can catch this and more at technori.com. Join us for the newsletter. And of course, you can follow us on social at technori. Follow me at Katoon, or find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, wherever it is. Boom. That's a wrap.